Tonight, we're going to have a fun topic. We're actually going to begin talking about things that couples do after betrayal, as well as beginning to lay out the very specific path and the task that couples have to follow in order to recover from an affair.
Tonight is part one of our series, The Road to Recovery After an Affair. If your spouse has already left, please don't tune out, because much of what we discuss tonight will also apply to your recovery.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I really am.
It's really, this is kind of, you know, as people read these things and talk about these things, they begin to kind of go, whoa, we did that. Oh, I did that one. And so you'll find that there's a lot of things in here that'll seem very familiar.
So just because your spouse has left the marriage doesn't mean you don't have your own recovery. But before we go into the specific tasks of recovery, we're going to begin by sharing the top 10 most common mistakes the betrayed spouse makes. And as we go into this portion of the show, I encourage you all, if you've done these things, please have some grace with yourself. Don't beat yourself up. The reason they're most common is they're really the most common. At the end of the show, we'll be sharing the 10 most common mistakes the unfaithful spouse makes. So please stick around for the rest of the show.
Right. In other words, if your husband...
Or wife, has been
unfaithful, you may want to make sure you get them listening to this program before we get to the end of the program tonight.
Away from the Academy Awards.
Exactly.
Right. So here they are, folks. The 10 most common mistakes the betrayed spouse makes. Number 10, believing that once your mate agrees to end the affair or the behavior, that it's truly ended.
Quite often, the betrayed partner is somewhat naive and actually believes their spouse is able to effectively flip a switch and stop the behavior or communication with the affair partner. Actually, I believed it in my first marriage. It's a lovely thought, but really unrealistic. Recovery may involve seeking out pastors, helping professionals, those who are farther down the road, and possibly support groups and accountability. It takes time. Most people need assistance to effectively end an affair.
So it's not going to just kind of end when you say it's going to end?
No, but a lot of times they'll say, okay, it's over. They'll even make the phone call in front of their spouse, but then they'll talk to them later.
Can I tell a story about that?
I guess if it's a quick one.
Actually, just a story of someone trying to end it, and he thought he would be able to end it, and so we actually worked out this wonderful script, and we had the affair partner come into the office so he could just deliver his wonderful speech.
And this is with professional help.
Yes. Right. So this is it. And we don't advise you do this at home. This is only for professionals. But anyway, so he gives this wonderful little speech of what he's going to say. And this woman kind of looks at him. And then she jumps up, runs across the room, grabs him by the throat, pulls him into her face and says, "I will not let you go." And I'm going, oh, my word. I've never seen that before in my life. And I began to realize that breaking an affair is a lot harder than getting over maybe a bottle of beer, because a bottle of beer has never called any or grabbed a hold of anybody and began to strangle them.
Yes, but some people have trouble with that, too. Different
right.
subject.
So you don't have to necessarily believe it, but it is hard. So things will happen that will sabotage
breaking
it off. But
we're going to forge ahead.
That's right. I'm sorry.
So on that happy note, number 9. Placing too much confidence in changed phone numbers and email addresses.
Although this can be helpful, it is not sufficient. It won't keep your mate from opening a new email account, getting a calling card, or buying a new cell phone.
That's right.
That's it on that one, huh?
That was great.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
Okay,
do you want me to tell a story?
No more stories. Number 8. Contacting the affair partner. Believing that they're truthful and that trying to drive them off or appeal to their conscience will end positively somehow.
I got lots of stories on
that. All right. Yeah. Well, you may have to tell a story on this one.
I don't think so. We're just going to have to keep them quiet. But it's amazing how many times a hurting spouse comes in with a story of what happened when they call the affair partner. For some strange reason, they think the affair partner is going to tell the truth, sorrowfully repent, and apologize for what they've done when they realize the pain they've caused. What really happens is the affair partner will usually lie. Sometimes they'll even manipulate the situation to hurt the betrayed spouse even more. Remember, an affair affects a person's ability to think, and that includes not just your spouse, but their affair partner.
Right. And if a fair partner has already had an affair with your mate, the fact that you would actually believe that maybe they would be truthful with you in the first place would seem to kind of lean toward naivete a little bit.
To have some grace with yourself if you've done it.
That's right.
Lots
That's
of
right.
other people have.
That's right. You wouldn't be the only one.
It's just not so helpful. We don't recommend it.
Right. Okay, then. Number 7. Believing that you can keep your spouse safe and away from temptation.
As tempting as it seems, you cannot keep your spouse safe.
Or your spit, too.
Yeah, too much talking over the weekend. You can even work with them. But really, it's up to them. They have to be committed to quitting the affair, staying safe, and you cannot watch them 24/7.
And those are good intentions. They just don't work.
Number 6, bringing your kids into the middle of the situation, or using your kids as pawns to manipulate your spouse into staying, or using them to punish him or her if they leave, or finally using them as confidants.
It's amazing how often people put their kids in the middle of this. I don't think they intentionally mean their children harm. But kids need both of their parents, and they don't need to be pulled in two directions. They also don't need to know all the dirty details. If your children are older, you probably will need to talk to them, but even they don't need every detail. They still need both parents.
Absolutely.
No, and some people just make hurtful decisions in the midst of their hurt, and we completely understand that.
And, yeah, I think that sometimes in that point of crisis, too, kids may ask questions, and so it's really tempting to want to let it know, be known kind of what's going on, and that really is tempting, too.
Yeah.
It is, but then they just end up being unloaded on.
Right.
Right. And sometimes kids will kind of take it out on the safe parent, who's actually the one who's not having the affair. And we'll talk about that on a later show sometime. But number 5, bludgeoning your mate with God's word, thinking that this will be helpful. And we've had some real veterans on this one. Huh?
When it comes down to it, they already know what they're doing is wrong. Otherwise, they would have told you up front. If you do this, it will only push them away.
Number 4, try to compete with the affair partner, pornography, or prostitutes, you know, whatever the sort of sin of choice may be. And that's including trying to get attention from others to make them jealous.
Yeah, when it comes down to it, the affair, the sexual behavior, is not necessarily due to something that's wrong in the marriage or the sexual relationship. But even if it is, an affair and a marriage are apples and oranges. You can never compete with an affair.
Yeah, we're up against the clock here, so we'll try to finish this off. Number 3, using guilt, shame, or threats to get them to stay.
Actually, if this tactic would be helpful, they never would have had the affair. They already have guilt, shame, and they already have had moments when they knew what they were up against.
Number 2, trashing the affair partner, one of my favorites.
And this is truly one of the most common mistakes hurting spouses make. If your spouse is ambivalent, they have one foot in the marriage, one foot out of the marriage, trashing the affair partner is only going to push them away.
And the number 1 most common mistake, believing that there's a simple formula or a set course to fix the problem.
It would be really nice if there were, but truly each affair is a little bit different. God is creative. There are all kinds of solutions to this. There's no set path. No set course, but with God at the center of it, there is hope.
Amen. So, during this segment, we're going to begin talking about the long and winding road of recovery. What are the different and specific tasks? The task that we want to begin with tonight, and I believe really the first task, and recovery really doesn't even begin until you accomplish task number 1. And that is actually the telling of the story. That ultimately, until you begin to reveal what has happened, and I think in as much detail ultimately as the hurt spouse wants, then you never really begin the process. We believe that as long as there are secrets, there are parts of the story untold, then it's in those places the devil still has a stronghold, that we're only as sick as our secrets, so to speak. And there's always a place of not completing this first task as long as you're holding on to very specific secrets. Now, in the telling of the story, in many ways, we look at it like a 5x7 canvas, that there's this huge painting. I mean, that's the painting of our life.
5 feet by 7 feet,
yeah,
not inches.
Not inches, 5 feet by 7 feet. Thank you very much. And the problem for most people beginning to tell about their infidelity is that they use a 2-inch by 2-inch frame to begin to reveal to their mate ultimately what has happened. And so the mate is kind of left in the dark trying to figure out what's really going on, which is most definitely not helpful. It's like, again, I think we mentioned this before, trying to work a jigsaw puzzle in the dark. You know, you're having to create pieces, you're trying to figure out what's going on, and until they feel that they truly understand what's happened in the story, what has occurred in this situation, they have no sense of the ability to kind of let go of the discovery phase until they come to that point. Now, during that discovery phase, we oftentimes recommend the use of a polygraph just to establish that ultimately the entire story has been told. Now, even if you're telling the story, I remember this weekend there was a gentleman that was trying to explain his story to his wife. And he finally said, okay, I've given you the outline, the outside edges of the canvas. He said, I've got a lot of details to still fill in, but at least, you know what the parameters of this thing are. And that was the place that he began with the story. And it was actually a very good place. It's a process as you go through that.
And it was really helpful that he admitted to her he was still working on it, because what happens for the betrayed spouse is every time they get a new piece of information, they feel like they're knocked back to square one. And so once they get one piece of information, they feel like they process it, work through it, come to a place of hope, commit to forgiveness, they get some more and they just feel knocked back, and it really creates a lot of hopelessness to do it that way.
Yeah, and this is one of those places where I think you really have to look out for shame, because shame will tell you you have to keep this thing in the dark and not tell anybody. And sometimes a lot of the betrayers that we work with think they're doing their husband or wife a favor by taking the attitude that they're going to take this thing to their grave and never tell them.
Right, and we call this the story getting down to ground zero. That until you get to ground zero and you clear away all the rubble, it's very, very difficult to actually begin rebuilding the marital process. I mean, there's, again, always a piece of work left undone unless you clear the deck, let them know what's happened. And as I discovered in my own recovery, is that I could never be loved unconditionally as long as I only conditionally let my mate know what had happened. And the other thing I'll say, I think a lot of times when people don't tell the full story, they'll claim it's because they don't want to hurt their mate. But really, we hurt our mate when we did the wrong thing. It's not like the information is the point where they got hurt. They got hurt when this thing occurred. When we refuse to tell the story, ultimately what we're doing is being control freaks. We're controlling their decision and their ability to make an informed decision. And actually, their decision to trust in God in terms of how God's going to work this thing out. I mean, the problem is we don't want to let go of the control. And that's why we don't tell. And I also believe that if they really wanted to know, and that's a great question, would they want to know? Then why wouldn't you tell them?
Right, because this weekend I think one husband was really astounded by his wife's response when he finally came to ground zero. They had taken a few shots at it, and she's like, I'm relieved. It finally makes sense. I'm not going crazy.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that her first thought was, okay, I knew it. I'm not crazy. And the problem is when we lie and we don't tell the story and God's Holy Spirit's convicting them anyway of what's really been there, what we're doing is a phenomenal disservice, because we're telling them that the discernment that the Holy Spirit is giving them, that all of their radar, all of their, you know, spiritual intuition is off. And so we kind of begin to skew their meters. We skew their ability to understand what's really occurred.
And I guess just one note of caution. We recommend the 24-hour rule is what we call it. If your spouse in their pain and anger begins doing what I call rapid-fire shooting of questions, let them know that they really need to think about it for 24 hours. But they need to know that if they really want the answer to that question, that they'll get it, because they need to know that they're in control of the information their unfaithful spouse is not.
Yeah, one final word I would want to say on everything, too. For those of you, you know, who are really struggling with whether to tell your secret or not, You know, I know it sounds crazy, and this is not one of the most popular messages that we say to tell people, but believe us when we say it takes a tremendous amount of emotional energy to carry a secret like that throughout a marriage, and it'll just continue to undermine the fabric of your relationship.
Right, and so now I think we're going to move on to the second task.
And the second task is understanding why this thing has happened. And you know, for a couple who's experiencing infidelity, beginning to understand the why that this happened may be even more important than knowing what or how. You know, culture has a tendency to offer a lot of information on what to do or how to do it, but there seems to be a shortage of information on the why part. And understanding the why will not only provide new ways of considering what's happened, but it'll also provide the ability to adapt and to address new circumstances that may come in the future. You know, one of the primary goals will be to provide a common understanding for both mates as to why this happened, to allow you to be on the same page when it comes to determining what needs to be done to both heal and to avoid this thing from happening again in the future. Failure to understand the why may result in continued fear of the future. So basically, it will be the acceptance of the past and of your own failures that provide the vehicle to live in the solution rather than living in the problem. It's kind of one of those things that about understanding history to keep it from repeating itself.
The third task that we have on our list is safety. And safety is a real concern after infidelity is exposed, both in terms of emotions and actual physical safety. Anger, as you may or may not know, is one of the more common emotions after infidelity is disclosed. And it's really important for both parties to be committed to making the other person feel safer. As John mentioned earlier, we're at the tail end of an EMS, and as part of the weekend, we have mentors come out and share their story. And the mentor couple this weekend, it was the husband who was unfaithful, and he jokingly mentioned that the night that he had disclosed his infidelity, he really, really wished he had a bed behind a locked door, and he laughed. But the truth is, it's a valid concern.
That's exactly right, because sometimes for the hurt spouse, it feels like what they want to do is help their mate feel the same pain they're feeling. And safety isn't just about the hurt spouse trying to kill the unfaithful spouse. Sometimes safety is very much about an issue that or something the unfaithful spouse has to be able to offer the hurt spouse.
Oh, absolutely. That's a big part of it. A lot of times couples come in and talk about trust. And we really don't talk about trust. We talk about safety.
But we don't believe that trust is a necessary component of a great marriage. I believe you can always substitute honest and deep communication for trust. In fact, the problem with trust is oftentimes it actually allows shortcuts in the marriage. I mean, if you have a boss that really trusts you, do you have less or more contact with them? Well, typically it's less. And so couples, sometimes it's the trust in their marital relationships that actually begin to cause the disconnection. Safety is really the more needed element for a marital relationship, that if I can begin to establish safety, then it becomes possible for us to begin to engage and to connect at very different levels. And again, that safety is necessary, that both parties agree to provide the safety for the mate.
And there are a lot of practical tools that the unfaithful spouse can use to help the other person feel safe. There's spyware, letting them have access to their phone, not keeping any secrets, not keeping receipts out of the house, and I think we're ready for the break.
As we continue talking about this thing tonight, we want to look at boundaries, and Leslie, why don't you tell us about boundaries here?
Well, boundaries are an issue that come up in regards to safety, and basically a boundary defines what is me and what is not me. And it's my belief that they need to be flexible and God-centered. A lot of times when people begin to talk about boundaries, what they actually are talking about is building walls, one brick at a time, to keep themselves safe. And I really believe that over time it's easy for somebody who's been hurt in a marriage or by infidelity to become a gray fortress that's impenetrable. And truly, God has to be at the center of the drawbridge. Really, a boundary needs to be set in love for oneself and one's mate. The unfaithful partner really needs to begin to look at their own boundaries to keep themselves from reconnecting with the affair partner or even beginning a new affair. Because a lot of times, affairs begin with poor boundaries.
Right, and I think if anybody, again, out there has any questions about boundaries, certainly give us a call, because boundaries are a big issue, and how we set those boundaries, what we do with those boundaries, what makes it safe. I mean, even the boundaries of how much information do we tell. So those are big issues as we begin to do the task of safety.
Well, and one thing to just add on to that, the betrayed partner really needs to set up some boundaries, some expectations for their mate, but they're not to be punitive or abusive. It's really in, I guess, with love, safety, and God at the center of it, not with punishment and revenge.
Right. The second thing under safety that we feel like is really important, the little task you've got to complete, is how in the world do you deal with intrusive thoughts? The intrusive thought thing that it can be quite vexing for someone actually who's been hurt, or also the intrusive thoughts can be a problem for the unfaithful spouse. But what happens is, you may begin to see, just have vivid memories of what your mate may have done with another person. There can be a million reminders in any given day. For instance, you may be driving down the road, see a billboard for a topless club, and if your husband's been doing topless clubs, I guarantee you, that's going to be a reminder. Country Western songs will sit there and be huge reminders. Cell phone calls, not cell phone calls, every time the computer's up. Depending on what your mate has done for the unfaithful spouse, or for the hurt spouse, those reminders will actually create quite a firestorm. And so learning to control those reminders and to keep from being absolutely consumed and overwhelmed by those thoughts is actually a task that has to be accomplished. In the same way, for the unfaithful spouse, they may have all kinds of, if they've been, for instance, in an affair, per se, may have all kinds of thoughts about their affair partner during the day, have lots of fantasy about their affair partner. Or for an addict, they may be having fantasies about porn, using a porn, what they could do. Again, if you don't learn how to control those thoughts, if you don't develop the techniques necessary to deal with that, then ultimately this thing will sweep you away and take you to someplace you don't want to go.
So what are the techniques, Rick?
Well, one of the techniques that we're going to go into techniques, huh? One of the techniques that we deal with that I really like is what we call our little life acronym. And the life acronym is whenever an intrusive thought comes, we just have people label it. I mean, oftentimes we know that that's not what we want. We know it's not who we are. I mean, Romans chapter 7 says, the things I want to do, I don't. The things I don't want to do, those are the things I keep on doing. If I do the things I don't want to do, then I have to admit that ultimately there's another way in my heart that I really want to be. It's just that I'm incapable of doing that. In fact, he says, as it is, it's no longer me doing it, but it's sin in me. Frequently, these things, this sin nature, can capture us. And it is continually trying to discourage us, deceive us, define us, making us think this is who we are. So we teach people all the time, label it, you know, that's sin. We operate from identity. That's not me. That's sin in me. The F stands for focus. That really, the trick to overcoming intrusive thoughts is not to try not to think about them. We always say, hey, think about a pink elephant. Okay, when you quit thinking about the pink elephant, let us know. Because with intrusive thoughts, the more you focus on them, the more they capture your attention. Whatever, with focus, whatever captures your attention ultimately will capture you. Whatever you focus on is really going to expand. So it's imperative that we learn to shift our focus onto something else. I mean, we would tell you, fix your eyes on Christ, the author and perfecter of our faith, that there are certain techniques, such as scripture memorization, where we can literally begin to focus on those things. And it's not a matter of trying not to think about the intrusive thought, but it's thinking about something else, putting something else in the foreground and letting the intrusive thought go off in the background, so that ultimately that intrusive thought will fade. In fact, research shows that most intrusive thoughts will fade within 20 minutes if you stay focused on something very different. And then the E in the little life acronym, label, identity, focus, evaluate, you know, we always ask, have people ask the questions. Look, if you think about this, if you do this, is it going to bring life or is it going to bring death? Usually, we can see in those terms. In our mind, I believe we always have two voices going. The voice of the shepherd, the voice of the butcher. The voice of the shepherd is life-giving, encouraging, it's freeing, it's edifying. The voice of the butcher, on the other hand, is condemning, it's negative, it's critical, it's doubtful. I think that we have the ability to determine in our mind, is this the voice of the shepherd or is this the voice of the butcher? Finally, we always look at Romans 6 where it says, what benefit is there now from those things that we're so ashamed of? Those things lead to death.
Well, and just to add something on, a lot of times the betrayed spouse thinks, if I can just think about this enough, it won't hurt anymore. But they end up ruminating it over and over and over and have a huge emotional response and build hopelessness. And it becomes all they can focus on.
Yeah, it can
and
become,
so it doesn't work.
It can become like a bad tape player in your head that just keeps playing back the negative message, and that just causes a downward spiral.
But for that reason, you know, you need to begin to evaluate. You've got to begin to devalue those thoughts. Like they're saying, understand that there's really no benefit in following that train of thought. All it's going to do is capture your heart and take you away from Jesus. Anything else you'd add?
Yeah,
to that?
I would say that, you know, kind of for the focus shift part of that, we've had some clients who've been pretty creative on stuff to fill their mind with at that point. I mean, we've had people memorizing Shakespeare, a favorite poem, a favorite set of scriptural passages and things, but just having something ready to go to throw into the fray in your mind when the negative ideas start coming.
Or turning on a favorite song, something that just distracts you.
Right. Now, in addition, in the task of safety, the next thing is relapse prevention. And on relapse prevention, you've got to begin to figure out how in the world are we going to keep this from happening again, because if you don't, the hurt spouse, and maybe the person that needs to work on relapse is the hurt spouse, whichever, either the unfaithful spouse or the hurt spouse, both of you need to figure out what are you doing that's creating death in the other person. And you need to come up with a program, an ability to see a strategy of how you're going to keep from ultimately destroying your mate as you go through this process. Because what you don't want is your marriage to become a paper shredder that is literally churning the two of you up as you go through the process. And relapse prevention is one of the things that we put into place as we recover, that actually begins to provide safety. And I don't know how much we want to go into relapse prevention. Maybe we could do a whole program on relapse prevention.
We probably will be doing a whole program right. on relapse prevention.
And John, what about anger?
Yeah,
the last one.
Boy, I tell you what, anger is almost certainly going to be an element in the recovery process somewhere. And boy, howdy, we've seen some very angry people walk through our doors in the past. But interestingly, sometimes we talk about anger as being a secondary emotion, meaning that it's hiding something else. Behind the veil of anger, we'll usually find in some level hurt or fear or something like that, something along those lines. And the trauma that's created by betrayal can create an abundance of both of those emotions. And sometimes when people are dealing with all this emotional overload, anger is just kind of something they can latch onto and get their head around as a sort of a what feels like a safe way for them to express it.
And it actually, I think, makes them feel a little bit more powerful. It's, I think, much easier in some ways, instead of going to your mate and saying, I'm really hurt, I'm really afraid, because they seem like the enemy because they have hurt you and increased your fear, to come at them angrily because you feel a little bit more powerful and less vulnerable. But it's not so helpful.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why the betrayed spouse sometimes is hesitant to let go of their anger, because they sort of hold on to it like a teddy bear. But one of the things we often say, too, that I think is important is that anger is neither good nor bad. It's sort of what we do with it that becomes problematic. And for someone who's been betrayed, I mean, there's a self-protective part of that anger that they need. They just need to find a way to express it in a healthy way that's not going to hurt them or the people around them.
And some good ways to maybe deal with your anger are to journal, talk to a safe friend, exercise. It's important for you, though, to get to the emotions behind the anger. Because you really need to be able to talk to your spouse about your hurts and your fears without the energy of the anger.
And I don't know that I would totally agree, John, that anger is neither good or bad. I think there can be a bad anger. I mean, I think that, yeah, you're saying the anger is not the problem. It's the expression of the anger. And Jesus is real clear on that. He says, be angry, but sin not. Mm-hmm. And I think the place where anger moves into sin, just for those of you who are interested, is when it becomes something that is done that it's not loving. When it moves away from love and it becomes about trying to hurt the other person as a result of what the other person's done to me, when I'm angry and I don't care, I may not intentionally be trying to hurt the other person, but I really don't care that my words hurt, then I just missed the first commandment that Jesus actually gave, or the most important commandment, which is love each other. And if I allow my anger to move outside of love, even in the midst of a cotton-picking affair, it is not acceptable. That's not where we are. That's not who we are. We are, as you know, Jesus says, they will know that you are mine by your love for each other. And even in affairs, that's how they're going to know that we're his. So we're up against the break again, so we'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Thank you. During this next segment, we're going to begin talking about the 10 most common mistakes unfaithful spouses make as they move to the point that we just heard from a clip from Fatal Attraction. We can be reached at area code 512-365-9930. It's obvious the devastation caused by this, even from a movie clip, is just phenomenal. And there really are mistakes that the unfaithful spouse makes as they begin to move through the process. So, John?
So, here we go. Again. 10 most common mistakes the unfaithful spouse makes. Number 10. Not answering all of his or her questions.
Yeah, that one is really a no-brainer. Because later, if that information begins to come out because you didn't answer the question, or as they begin to ask questions, you forget what you said, you are far better off going ahead and painting it as black as you can paint it. So at least they know that you're trying to be completely honest with them.
Yeah, and they need, once again, to know that they're in control of how much information they get, and if they want the detail, they're going to have to deal with it. It's not up to you.
Right.
Number 9, telling your spouse to forgive you.
Yeah, you know, in reality, our forgiveness, for those of you who have been unfaithful, comes from the Lord Jesus Christ. It is not something that comes from our mate. Forgiveness is something, it's a gift that you give yourself. It's really something I want to help facilitate in my mate and the hurt spouse for their benefit. But to tell them to forgive me actually just puts a moral imperative on them and really is not even what I need. If I'm looking to them for their forgiveness, then ultimately I have made them my God.
Well, and the other thing that sometimes the betrayed spouse, the mistake they make is if their spouse says that very evening, "I forgive you," the truth is they're still in shock. They haven't gotten their head around what it is they're forgiving, and they're still going to need to work on it. So yeah. Even if they say it, take it with a grain of salt.
And forgiveness is definitely one of those topics we'll be revisiting repeatedly as we spend this Sunday nights with you. So here we go. Number 8, telling a lie of any sort.
That would seem to go without saying.
And that's bank statements, too.
Yeah. You know, the problem with telling a lie is even if they're beginning, and we talked earlier that trust is not necessarily a great necessary component, but I'll tell you, truthfulness is incredibly important in terms of developing safety, because if they can't believe what you're telling them and you get caught in a lie, you just went back to ground zero.
Even what you had for lunch.
Right. Exactly. Just tell it. Let it go.
Number 7. Pointing out your spouse's faults and failures.
Yeah, oftentimes when a hurt spouse will ask the unfaithful spouse why, the first thing they will say is, well, if you'd been a better wife, or if you had done this, or you'd been having more sex, I really wouldn't have needed to go out and do this sort of thing. So by pointing that out to them, ultimately what you've done is you've dodged having to take personal responsibility, and you've pushed away your guilt by basically Adam's kind of technique, which was, well, this woman God you gave me, she made me do it. So you really don't want to go back to the oldest trick in the book.
No, and we really try to separate the infidelity, the train wreck, from the marriage. If there were deficits in the marriage, you'll need to come back to them after you deal with the train wreck.
Right.
Number 6, trying to avoid talking with your spouse about their feelings.
You know, one of the things I believe is that for the unfaithful spouse, you've got to be a tornado chaser. I mean, typically when we see a tornado coming, most of us want to run to a storm shelter. And so it's very, very frightening to begin to talk to a hurt spouse, because as those feelings begin to come out, they can actually come out in wild, torrential geysers or whatever. It can be pretty scary for them. And the thing that I think the unfaithful spouse needs to understand is that the way that a hurt spouse heals is by processing what's actually occurred. Women in particular need to touch the wound 1,000 times until they don't get some sort of electrical jolt. Frequently, the unfaithful spouse thinks that their mate is really just trying to punish them by talking about it over and over, when in reality, that's the healing process. So you need to be able to let them talk. Don't avoid letting them talk about feelings.
And if you try to lasso in the tornado, it will just get bigger.
Yeah, it'll suck you up.
Number 5. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, this one is actually potentially hazardous to your health, trying to defend your affair partner.
Yeah. One of the things you need to understand, even though I know that when I went to recovery, one of the first things I did was I took full responsibility and I said, hey, this is not her fault. Because I was trying to be a good guy. I mean, I was trying to sit there and take responsibility. In reality, my mate needed to be able to be upset with my affair partner. She did not need me to go, my affair partner really did not need my defense of her. She had done her own thing too. Now, I still think I had to take 100% responsibility, but don't try to minimize your mate's upset with the affair partner.
Number 4, living life as normal.
Yeah, pretend normal. One of the things we talk about all the time, you do not want to pretend normal in this type of relationship. You just need to go in and say, you know, this has happened. You need to talk. Every time you see them, say, if you see the storm clouds gathering overhead, say, hey, do we need to talk? Don't keep going to the bar after work. Come home. Change how you're doing things. Things are not normal.
And they're thinking about it all the time. So if you bring it up, if you're not reminding them, they're already thinking of it.
Number 3, believing that once you and your affair partner have decided to do the right thing and return to your marriages, that the affair is indeed over.
Yeah, I really want to express this one. We only break up to make up with affair partners. I'm telling you, the number one way if affair is continued is by breaking up mutually an affair. Affairs do not get broken unilaterally or bilaterally. It's not a joint decision. If you and your affair partner jointly decide to break off an affair, you just made a decision together to maintain a covert alliance where ultimately you still stay connected. Affairs get broken up by one person saying, I'm done, and by the face of God, I'm out of this thing, and you don't even get your affair partner's permission. You just do it.
Because if you both agree, you actually have just increased the intimacy between the two of you.
Yeah, now you're really working together on something. Woohoo!
Number 2, leaking out information over time.
Yeah, please don't do this one, guys. I mean, this is really painful because it's like if you take, like I did, about 6 weeks to finally get that 5x7 foot canvas, you take it 2 inches at a time. When you slowly get out information, it really begins to kill hope for your mate, because every time they feel like they're getting the wind back in them, you knock it out again with another piece of information. Please try to get all the information out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it's just kind of getting a rug pulled out of you, underneath you repeatedly. All right, gang. Number 1 mistake the unfaithful spouse makes, being defensive.
Yeah, you know, it's really difficult not to be defensive. I think that frequently in the revelation stage, this first task where we're talking about telling the story, a lot of times the hurt spouse will say, why? In reality, at this initial stage, anything you say will be defensive. There's only 2 really good responses you can give your mate on the front end in order to keep from being defensive. The first one is this. If they're right, even up to 5%, and that's all, say, you're right. That works pretty good. If they're wrong, you say, I deserve that. If they say, why, you say, I don't know, I'm trying to discover that.
And I hate that I hurt you.
Yeah, exactly. I hate that I hurt you. I appreciate the fact that you're even speaking to me at this point. So, I guess we're beginning to come to the end of our time tonight.
Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me?